Stockholm, Paris, Berlin, Kiev, Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam, Bucharest, Welcome to Network Europe, a partnership of the continent's leading international broadcasters. I'm Sarah Elzis in Paris. This week, we have a mix of the serious and the not so serious. We look at the implications of opening communist archives in Poland.
Probably the only alternative is either to burn everything or to deposit it for 100 years or 50 years to be untouched, or open all the files.
Controversy over a cluster bomb ban in Sweden.
In the domestic Swedish debate, there have been talks about whether some Swedish weapons are human or not. And I would like to say that no bombs are human. The purpose with the bomb is to kill people. And you have to keep that in mind.
And, well, this.
There are also songs from the 18th century which are perhaps a little bit pornographic and rather rough.
These stories and more coming up on Network Europe. The Constitutional Court in Poland last week shot down a vetting law aimed at purging ex-communist agents out of public life. The 11-judge panel declared unconstitutional numerous clauses requiring members of certain professions, including journalists, to declare whether they had collaborated with the communist-era secret police. The ruling was a rebuke to President Lech Kaczynski and his twin brother, Prime Minister Jarosław Kaczynski, who campaigned on rooting out communists. Michael Kubicki of Polish Radio's external service reports that in reaction to this decision, some in Poland are now looking to open communist police archives to the public.
The verdict of the Constitutional Tribunal appeared to be a setback for the conservative government and the president, and a source of satisfaction for the opposition. But all the main players on Poland's political scene agree that the verdict did not put an end to the vetting process. After the first round of talks with parliamentary leaders earlier this week, President Lech Kaczynski said that agreement was reached on fully opening the secret police archives. This is not to say that they all see eye to eye on all issues.
For some, it is of primary concern who will have arbitrary power to delete all sensitive personal details from the files. For others, this is of secondary importance, the crucial thing being to ensure that such sensitive information really remains confidential.
The notion of sensitive information refers to issues such as sexual orientation and details relating to private life. But is the opening of the files a realistic prospect, if only considering the time factor? I put the question to Robert Strybel, the Warsaw-based correspondent of Western Media.
It's realistic. I guess it can be done. It's feasible. Maybe that's the word to use. It's feasible to some extent, but what the result will be is quite doubtful. Probably the only alternative is either to burn everything or to deposit it for 100 years or 50 years to be untouched, or open all the files. You can't selectively open files because that's impossible. Every group will have a resentment towards being chosen.
What appears to be something of a paradox for an outside observer of the Polish scene is that, unlike other post-communist countries, Poland has been unable to adopt a good vetting law for so many years. According to most commentators, the problem has its roots in the events of 1989. They were a catalyst for change in the whole of Central Europe. But as Marcin Sobczyk of Interfax Central Europe stresses, the Polish opposition and communist elites agreed at that time to a soft transition of power.
Former communists became very powerful business people, almost as if they had never done anything wrong, as if the communist era was in fact only a period of democracy, or it was some kind of a worse kind of democracy, but it was a democracy. And for the past 20 years, we've had two camps that were saying, yes, we should do the moral right and tell the truth about what was happening in Poland, while the other camp was defending that deal. As the new generations are coming to politics are becoming commentators. Those generations that don't remember communism, and they do not remember that deal, they also stopped honoring it.
It seems certain that the shape of the vetting law will remain at the top of the political agenda in Poland for a long time.
That report from Polish Radio's external services, Michael Kubicki. Romania's president faces an impeachment referendum this weekend. Traian Băsescu was already suspended by parliament last month for allegedly usurping the prime minister's powers. The constitutional court ruled that Băsescu didn't break the law. The ruling was non-binding, though, so the decision of whether or not to let him stay in office is put to voters. But this is more than a referendum on a president. Radio Romania International's Iulian Mureșan looks deeper into the difficulty Romania faces of maintaining a relatively independent justice system. He spoke first to Mircea Joana, the leader of Romania's opposition Social Democratic Party.
At stake in this referendum is not the political future of Traian Băsescu, but the future of Romania. What kind of democracy and political environment will have in the next 2 years? Romania must keep on functioning. Romania must prove to its citizens and to Europe that we are a functioning democratic state.
The suspended president, however, has a different story. Traian Băsescu's discourse is something like this. Romania is currently led by an oligarchy, that is, a handful of very rich and very powerful people who control the majority of Romania's parliament. These people are currently being prosecuted, and Băsescu claims that if prosecutors are left alone, and if justice is doing its job, these people risk ending up behind bars. According to Romanian journalist Traian Ungureanu, justice is the real stake of this battle.
This entire agitation, the internal political fight that has plagued Romania in recent months, this whole war broke out because of justice. Justice is not just an episode or a partial pretext. Justice lies at the very heart of this conflict. Even if the politicians on either side of the barricade would never admit this, I'm sure that for the Romanian voters, justice remains the main issue. We are now in a totally absurd situation. No one is able to say, for instance, why the president has been suspended. The legal grounds are non-existent. At the same time, the impeachment procedure, for which even its initiators have no arguments, this impeachment procedure started when dignitaries started having problems in the courts of justice.
Brussels has recently voiced concern about the continuation of the reform of the legal system. German MEP Markus Ferber has sent a letter to EU Commissioner for Justice Franco Frattini, urging him to consider the possibility of activating the safeguard clause on justice for Romania. Even the United States ambassador to Bucharest is concerned about the recent developments within the Ministry of Justice. The reason? The new Minister of Justice, 30-year-old Tudor Chiariu, has asked for the resignation of Doru Tuluș, a prosecutor who has been working on the files of the so-called big fish of corruption. The former Minister of Justice, Monica Macovei, who's been very much appreciated in Brussels for starting the reform of the judiciary, and to whom we owe to a large extent Romania's integration into the EU, accuses political pressure on prosecutors.
It's obvious that politicians are trying to interfere with the activity of the National Anti-Corruption Directorate. That is, they're trying to stop the investigations. I'd like to reiterate, in case there are people who still don't know it, that this department, led by Mr. Tuluș, started investigations in the biggest number of fraud and corruption cases last year, indicting many politicians across the political spectrum and contributing to lifting the EU red flag for corruption. It is obvious that the government and the people who rule the country these days, they want to intervene and stop investigations in these files.
In the meantime, the Romanian parliament passed the law on the National Agency for Integrity, an institution meant to control the illegal wealth of dignitaries. The law has been strongly requested by the EU since 2005. What former Minister of Justice Monica Macovei did not manage to do in 2 years, the new Minister of Justice, Tudor Chiariu, succeeded in a matter of days. The law has been passed by Parliament unanimously. Prime Minister Călin Popescu-Tăriceanu.
The law on the National Agency for Integrity has been one of the four major objectives set together with the European Commission, the most important, I would say. I congratulate Minister of Justice Tudor Chiariu for having managed to pass this law. I have strong doubts that his predecessor would have managed to do this, given her bad relation with Parliament.
The law passed by Parliament is different from that proposed by former Minister of Justice Monica Macovei. While the MPs say they made the law even tougher, there are voices that claim the law has been changed so that now it is completely useless. The EU has hailed the passing of the law. They haven't had a chance to analyse its content in detail, but they will do that before June this year, when Bucharest presents a report to the European Council and when the EU can activate a safeguard clause on justice if it thinks Romania has not taken the necessary steps in reforming its legal system.
That was Radio Romania International's Iulian Mureșan.
Europa.
L'Europe.
Europe.
You're tuned to Network Europe, still to come, erotic literature from a Vienna library. But first, the new French president, Nicolas Sarkozy, campaigned with proposals based on faulty economic analyses. This, according to an article posted on the website of a leading American newspaper, The Washington Post. France's new president, who was sworn in this week, said he would boost France's economy through tax cuts and by pushing back the 35-hour work week. But the article, written by Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, says there's little evidence that Sarkozy's proposals will actually increase employment or economic growth. Radio France International's Jan van der Made went to find out if economists in France agree. First up, Ali Fatemi, dean of the Graduate School of Business at the American University in Paris.
If you really want to talk about the French economy, you have to look at the rate of growth. France's economy is growing less than 2%, while in the UK, the economic growth is at least twice as high, and France is lower economic growth rate than average of Europe. So when you talk about the economic growth rate, then there are no problems with the numbers. It's very obvious that France's economy has been in recession for some 20 years.
Now for the solutions. I went to the OECD to ask what France should do about it's unemployment, for instance. This is Raymond Torres, analyst with the OECD.
Make sure that these workers do not leave the labor market altogether. The easiest solution is to put people on early retirement. This has been counterproductive because people go on early retirement. Many of them are not very happy, in fact, because they would have continued to work and could have continued to work. But in addition, this is a very significant cost to the budget, and this has to be funded from social contributions, which increase all the time, and therefore make it more difficult to hire people in the future. This is a vicious circle. So keep these people in the labor market. In addition to all this, training can help, because at the moment there are sectors which are expanding very fast and are facing labor shortages. Tourism sectors, in health sectors, there are at the moment some shortages there.
So give more training to people and shift them to healthier sectors. Marina Karabouf, who works for the employment agency ANPE, recently organized a fair to lure unemployed to the tourism sector, and she is optimistic.
We have 400 candidates and we have more job offers. We've got nearly 600 job offers. We know that we won't have enough candidates for all the job offers we have collected.
Nicolas Sarkozy's proposals are higher pay, more flexibility in the labor market, and making it easier for employers to fire people. Will it work? Professor Fatema again.
It's easy to make campaign promises, but when it comes to fulfilling them, I would be in a much better position to answer your question a month from now after the parliamentary elections are done. Because if he doesn't have a majority in the parliament, if he ends up with the cohabitation again, we're finished. That means 5 years that we're not good anywhere. But if he does have enough majority, and also if he knows how to negotiate with the unions, because unions can paralyze this country if they decide. I'm optimistic. I think the prospects, depending on what comes out of the elections, not everything that he has promised will take place. There's a joke about Mr. Brezhnev that he says under his time in Russia, he said, we pretended to pay the workers and they pretended to work. France is not that bad, but we get close to that. You know, if you don't pay enough people, then they just leave your job and they go and they have outside jobs. But if they are well paid and they're satisfied with their jobs, I think things work much better.
We now have to wait and see if the UMP, the party of France's new president, Nicolas Sarkozy, will win a majority in the legislative elections set for June the 10th and the 17th. And even if economic figures might not be reliable, almost everybody agrees that things have to change to make France and the French more prosperous.
Radio France International's Jan Vandermade reporting in Paris. We turn now to Sweden. The Swedish government is being accused of reneging on its promise to support an international ban on cluster bombs. In February, at a two-day conference in the Norwegian capital, Oslo, 46 countries pledged to work towards a new treaty banning them. But now in Sweden, the government is being accused of backtracking. As Radio Sweden's Azaria Kiros reports, the government may stand behind some kind of a ban as long as it doesn't include Swedish-designed bombs.
What's very disappointing is that up until very recently, Sweden was one of the most vocal supporters of an international treaty to ban cluster munitions.
The Cluster Munitions Coalition, the CMC, is an international organization working for the total ban of cluster bombs. And its coordinator, Thomas Nash, is utterly disappointed over the Swedish government's policy.
Very soon, Sweden is going to have to make a decision whether it is going to be one of the countries that supports an international ban or whether it is going to be one of the countries that stays outside this agreement, along with countries like Russia, China, the US.
The Swedish government rejects the accusations by the CMC and argues that it is working with other like-minded governments for the adoption of a comprehensive agreement. The Cluster Munitions Coalition is blaming Swedish Defence Minister Mikael Odenberg of creating an obstacle in the way of a blanket ban on cluster bombs. How does the Defence Minister reply to the accusation?
They are wrong. They are, of course, arguing against me and the Swedish government and arguing for a total ban.
What is wrong with a total ban?
We think that it is easier and to some degree more effective to have a regulation which focuses on the construction and on the use of these types of weapons. In the domestic Swedish debate, there have been talks about whether some Swedish weapons are human or not. And I would like to say that no bombs are human. The purpose with the bomb is to kill people. And you have to keep that in mind.
The bone of contention is the Swedish version of cluster bomb, the BK-90. The Swedish Defence Forces and the government claim it is not a cluster bomb in the true sense of the word and should not be included in the group of cluster bombs to be banned, an argument rejected by Cluster Munitions Coalition.
To say that some cluster munitions, such as the Swedish BK-90, should not be covered by this ban is absurd. The Swedish BK-90 has a wide area effect, just like all other cluster munitions. And secondly, the BK-90 also leaves unacceptably large numbers of unexploded ordnance.
The Swedish BK-90 is not a problem.
It hasn't it's a problem.
Well, it's not. It has obviously not caused anyone any harm. And even if it were used, it would have effects totally different from what we've seen recently, for example, in Lebanon. So let us focus on those weapons and types of weapons that in reality cause problems.
As the argument continues, Thomas Nash of the Cluster Munitions Coalition is challenging Defence Minister Mikael Odenberg to prove the safety of the Swedish cluster bomb, BK-90.
I would like to challenge the Swedish Defence Minister to walk through a field that has been struck with a BK-90 cluster munitions or other cluster munitions with self-destruct mechanisms and see how safe it seems.
If I was able to wait 30 minutes after the BK-90 had been dropped, I would gladly do so, because after 30 minutes there will be no explosions from parts of that bomb, because that's the way it is constructed.
The Defence Minister should look at the facts and should consider that even a cluster munition that would leave let's say, 1% unexploded ordnance would still be unacceptable if you use 100,000 submunitions from a BK-90 or any other type. Then you will have 1,000 unexploded duds that are deadly, landmine-like, unexploded ordnance.
That report from Swedish Radio's Azaria Kiros.
Europa.
L'Europe.
Europe.
You're tuned to Network Europe. As promised, here's the lighter part of the program. From cluster bombs to erotica. The Vienna Public Library is doing its best to shake off its staid image by setting up an erotic telephone hotline. Callers pay money to hear readings from the library's collection of erotic literature. Deutsche Welle's Carrie Skyring dialed in to find out more. First up, actress Anne Bennett.
Was interessieren dann Mariana die Hände, die sie berühren?
The revealing letters of a 17th century Portuguese nun, or the adventures of Casanova. Just press a button and settle down for some saucy literature or songs on the erotic library hotline. It costs 39 cents a minute, and according to library director Sylvia Martel-Vorm, the idea is to raise money and expose a broader public to its collection of original masterpieces.
This erotic collection is rather small. These are about 3,000 to 4,000 books, but it is a very specialized collection on erotics from the 17th century till the 20th century.
Sex sells, but the library says this is not any old porn. It wants to arouse interest in great literature.
Absolutely. It is from a very high quality, and it contains Marquis de Sade as well as Arthur Schnitzler, perhaps, or the Franz Blei. This is so-called high literature, yes? Now, naturally, there are also songs from the 18th century, which are perhaps a little bit pornographic and rather rough, you can say, but this is not the main part.
Für das Lied Rosettchen aus der CD Hur und Moll von Stefan Parüller drücken Sie die Taste 0.
A little wollen wir jetzt probieren, für unsere Madeln ein Studieren, Lidl San Modern.
Singer Stephen Parüller with songs of whores and molls, songs for after closing time. Just dial in and sing along. Not touching the right spot? Well, just pressed 2 and...
Für die Texte zu Casanova von H.C. Hartmann und Markus Walazza drücken Sie die Taste 2.
Vienna Library's erotic hotline is not exactly running hot. I'm told there's just too much heavy competition in the sex hotline business.
Naturally, we don't earn very much money with that because the half of the 39% go to the telecom and the other half to us. So we will not earn very much money with that.
If you speak German and lust after literature, the erotic library hotline could satisfy your needs. But if you want the real thing, I mean to read the books, you won't find them on the shelf. Like many a literary lover, they're kept under lock and key, and only a select few can enter. Kerry Skyring, Deutsche Welle Radio, Vienna.
Staying with the love, how about bureaucrats and romance? Wait, don't turn off your radio. It's not as dull as it sounds. It seems there's a dating service for European bureaucrats in Brussels, home to the European Parliament. And it also seems there's trouble. Radio Netherlands' Vanessa Mock has this story.
Heart-rendering lyrics that will no doubt be very familiar to hundreds of lonely hearts who are languishing away here in the EU capital. There's an army of single officials working here who've come from all over Europe to fulfill their one burning ambition of climbing up that Eurocrat ladder. But as we all know, it can be lonely up at the top, and nowhere more so than in Brussels' famously unromantic EU quarter, where the colour of the sky often mirrors the grey of the the buildings and where these bureaucrats spend long hours scribing away at EU directives in soulless offices. Laura Di Rossa has been working at the EU Council of Ministers for over two decades, and she says that love can be very hard to find in Brussels.
We work a lot on legislation, on things like this, and then when they go out, and it's often late in the evening, they go home, and in the morning they come back, so there's no life outside. For people who are not very open, it's not so easy. They want to meet each other.
Luckily, though, help is at hand thanks to a tailor-made agency called, appropriately enough, Euro Singles. Laura runs this club, and she says that some of its members have indeed made the happy transition from Euro Single to Euro Pair. But the agency's reputation has scandalously been dragged through the mud recently, with headlines that it's been attracting people looking for much more than just love, as EU official Bernard von Pusch found out to his cost.
Yes, well, there are people who are very interested in European officials, but not because of who they are, but for their wallets. It's not nice, but that's the way it is. Anyone who works at an embassy or at one of the European institutions earns quite an attractive salary, and that salary can be the source of the problems.
Bernard von Pusch, a divorcee, by the way, says his own wallet has been cleared out more than once after he was courted and romanced by female newcomers to the club, but then found that he was left to single-handedly foot the bill for all the whining and dining that came with the courtship. He says he's not the only one who's been left clutching an empty wallet, and that's why he called for Euro Singles to close its doors to anyone who doesn't work either within NATO or an EU institution, or who doesn't come personally recommended. Laura Di Rossa says that's taking it a step too far, and she for one regrets that the club has become so exclusive.
At the beginning, I think that it was because the two people had bad experience and they tried to protect themselves, but personally, I do not agree. For me, it's not related to our salary, because otherwise people working in multinational would say the same thing. I think that there are people who take advantages of someone else here or somewhere else.
But despite the tales of infiltration by gold diggers, Euro Singles is booming. There are over 250 members already, and many more are queuing up to join, although Laura Di Rossa won't be one of them. Have you tried to find love here in the European Council or across the road at the European Commission?
No.
Why is that? You wouldn't date a European bureaucrat?
Not specially.
That report was from Radio Netherlands, Vanessa Mock, reporting from Brussels. And that's it for Network Europe this week. Before we go, here's this month's quiz question. We'd like you to name two European female heads of state. If you think you have the answer, send it to contact@networkeurope.org. Include your name and where you're from. Visit our website, networkeurope.org, where you can hear this week's stories in our archives and subscribe to our podcast. Again, that's www.networkeurope.org. Thank you for listening. From me in Paris, this is Sarah Elzis. Since I'm in France, I'll end the show with a French song. This is Devenir Loup, Becoming a Wolf, by Caryl Milligan. C'est alourdi dans ma bulle d'argent.
la flamme du doute à la main d'un cocher qui recherche sa route par-delà les sentiers. Et j'attends que revienne au rendez-vous secret la vieille magicienne et mon âme se